From WHYY in Philadelphia, this is Fresh Air. I'm David Bianculli, sitting in for Terry Gross. On today's Fresh Air, faces, close up and larger than life with every wrinkle and every pore revealed. We talk with artist Chuck Close. There's a new large format book of his work. He's made paintings of faces since the 1960s. In the late 80s, Close suffered a stroke which left him paralyzed from the neck down. He taught himself to paint all over again. Also, we talk with actor Richard Gere. His latest film, The Hoax, is now out on DVD. Rock historian Ed Ward looks back at a single year in the life of Motown Records, and film critic David Edelstein reviews the new film from director Sidney Lumet. That's all coming up on Fresh Air. First, the news. This is Fresh Air. I'm David Bianculli, TV critic for the New York Daily News, in for Terry Gross. Our faces reveal so much about who we are. That's part of the fascination of the paintings of Chuck Close. They offer the chance to stare at larger-than-life, hyper-realistic renderings of faces. Faces transformed into what Time magazine art critic Robert Hughes described as moonscapes of pores, wrinkles, blackheads, and stubble. One of Close's most recent paintings is a 9x7 portrait of Bill Clinton. Reporter Alastair Sook wrote that the painting is, quote, a fittingly colossal portrait of a political colossus, and it is resolutely not sycophantic, unquote. Close has been painting faces for over 40 years, but it's remarkable that he can paint at all now. In 1988, a stroke left him paralyzed from the shoulders down. After a partial recovery, he resumed his work, seated in a wheelchair and using a wrist strap to hold his brushes. A major retrospective of his work has just been published, called Chuck Close Work, with accompanying text by museum curator and writer Christopher Finch. And tomorrow night, the American Ballet Theater will premiere Sea to Sea, Close to Chuck, a dance portrait inspired by his paintings, with music by Philip Glass, the subject of some of Close's most famous portraits. Terry spoke with Close in 1998.
Let's try to describe what's happening formally in your paintings. Your paintings are built not of like big elaborate brushstrokes, but of little dots or little circles. And it's the accumulation of all these dots or circles or squiggles, depending on the period that we're looking at, that kind of together add up to the larger structure of a face. But all the components are just really small dots or squiggles or bits
of
color.
There's no direct relationship between the photograph that I work from and the imagery that's embedded in that photograph and the marks that occur on the canvas. It's a little bit like translating from one language to the next. If you were to translate it directly, it might not make any sense. You sort of have to understand it in one language and then deconstruct it and reconstruct it in the new format. And of course, paintings don't happen the same way a photograph happens. Paintings are built, and my paintings are built incrementally, one unit at a time, in a way that's not all that different from, say, the way a writer would work. There's never any time that a writer is doing anything more than slamming one word up against the next and rejecting one word and slipping another one in and seeing how that works. And because I work incrementally, I do the same thing. I push little pieces of paint up against each other, and I work essentially from the top down, from left to right, and I build. I slowly build these paintings, construct them the way somebody might make a quilt or crochet or knit.
I want to talk a little bit more about the faces themselves, the way you paint the faces themselves. You've said that you tried to see the faces neutrally, without opinion or subjectivity, without editorializing in any way about the face. And yet, the face always reads in some way to me. I see the faces very subjectively, even though you as the painter didn't see them subjectively. Talk with me about the approach that you're taking toward the subject matter, of not kind of imposing any kind of feeling or point of view.
Well, it's not that I'm uninterested in the psychological reading of the paintings. I just don't want to lobby for one reading over all others, and to present them straightforwardly and flat-footedly without editorial comment, without cranking it up for extra psychological readings, or without drawing big circles around things saying, make sure you see it this way. I sort of leave it to the viewer to read the image. And I believe that a person's face is a kind of roadmap to their life. And embedded in the imagery is a great deal of evidence if you want to decode it. If a person has laughed his or her whole life, they'll have laugh lines. If they frown their whole lives, they have furrows in their brow. And it's not necessary for me to have them laughing or crying or anything in order to have people be able to read them.
Your canvases are very large, and because you include every detail of a person's face, every line and wrinkle and pucker and pore, every flaw is included, or what we would consider a flaw is not only included, but it's kind of enlarged because the painting is so large. And that's part of what I find so fascinating. The faces are so real and recognizable. Looking at one of your faces in a painting, it's a lot like looking at yourself in the bathroom mirror with the kind of harsh lighting that you have there, and you see everything. So there's something so recognizable about the landscape of the faces, the way you paint them.
Yeah, we don't stand close enough to each other. We don't invade each other's space enough to really be able to see the intimate level of detail that I typically put in one of these paintings, because they're, in fact, usually 9 feet high. So if there's more information than you ever really wanted to know about someone, and it makes it perhaps a more intimate experience. I make try to make these big, aggressive, confrontational images that you can see from clear across the room, and you have one kind of relationship with it there, and then another relationship at a middle viewing distance where you scan it and you can't readily see the thing as a whole. And then hopefully I've sucked the viewer right up to the canvas where you can see the individual marks and the methodology, how it got there. But in a way, what I've tried to do is make something, rip it loose from the context in which we normally see it, and make a kind of Brobdingnagian world, whereas the viewer behaves almost like one of Gulliver's Lilliputians crawling across the landscape of the face, not even necessarily always being aware of what it is that they're crawling across, stumbling on a beard hair and falling into a nostril. That makes it for a very active and very personal physical experience for the viewer, I think.
What kind of reactions do you get from people whose portraits you've done when they see their own faces blown up like that?
Well, everyone I've painted has had some kind of trouble dealing with it, and I would like to thank my sitters for their act of generosity, their extreme generosity, in lending me their image without knowing what I'm going to do with it and without any control over how I will use it. They have to put vanity aside, and these are not commissioned portraits, so I give them no right to really lobby for me improving the way they look, although I don't try to be particularly I don't try to be any more ruthless with them than I am with myself. But it is difficult to deal with, and some people have changed the way they look immediately after I painted them. They'll shave their mustache off, or they'll get a haircut, or they'll grow a beard or something. Only one person really anticipated this, and that was my friend, the painter Joe Zucker, who came essentially in disguise. I mean, he realized that all he had to do was present me with evidence that someone like that existed, wasn't necessarily him. And he ended up looking like a sort of Midwest used car salesman for a hundredth of a second. And he never had any trouble. He went home and he washed the Brill cream out of his hair, and it wasn't him. But most people have had to deal with it after I've painted them. But everyone has had, I think, some kind of trouble. If your nose is bent a quarter of an inch in real life, you can ignore it. But when a painting is 9 feet high, it'll be bent 6 inches, and it's very hard to convince yourself that it's not happening.
Chuck Close, speaking with Terry Gross in 1998. The new book collecting his work is called Chuck Close, Work. More after a break. This is Fresh Air. If you're just joining us, we're listening to Terry's 1998 interview with painter Chuck Close.
I've read that you've had a learning disability that's affected your ability to actually recognize faces in real life.
Yeah, I think I was probably driven to do what I do because I do have a, a great deal of difficulty recognizing faces. I have almost photographic vision for things that are two-dimensional, which is probably why I work from photographs instead of working from life. But I believe I was driven to painting the portrait, at least partially, by a desire to commit to memory and to really understand and scan the images of people that I care about, because I do have this trouble recognizing faces. And, of course, I don't remember their names either, so I'm in big trouble.
So one of the reasons why you paint from photographs is because you recognize faces better in two dimensions than in three, so it's easier for you to use a picture than a model. Are there other reasons why you work from photographs for your paintings?
Yeah, when you paint from life for an extended period of time, and my paintings have taken as long as 12 or 14 months, and routinely now take 3 or 4 months each. If you work from life, the subject gains weight and lose weight. The hair gets long and they cut it off, and they're happy, they're sad, they're awake, they're asleep. And the painting becomes a kind of mean average of all the changes that the model went through, plus whatever feelings you have for them while they're occupying your space. I would hate to have the subject in my studio for a year. So the photograph gives me an opportunity to have a poem-like frozen moment of time, sort of cuts across time, a hundredth of a second. And there's something of the freshness and the immediacy of that hundredth of a second is still there, hopefully, in the finished painting, which I construct over a more novelistic time frame. And it allows me to just keep working and to always refer back to the original photograph to see whether I actually saw what I thought I saw. And I often then recycle that photograph and make many more images. And it's really wonderful. Every time I go back to the photograph, because I've changed scale, tools, methodology, working method, and whatever, I find totally new information within the photograph that I didn't notice the first time.
Tell us a little bit about the way you work with grids when you're painting a face from a photograph.
Mm-hmm. Well, grids, you know, besides being one of the great modernist conventions, the grid has been around most recently because it's a flattening device. It's a way to restate the flatness of the canvas. But in fact, the use of a grid as a scaling up method goes back to ancient Egypt and was, of course, used in the Renaissance and used all along as a way to take a small drawing or a preparatory sketch and enlarge it by having smaller squares on the preparatory sketch and bigger ones on the painting. It's just a way to scale up an image. But all of my work from the 1960s on have been built with the use of a grid. I don't use a projector or anything like that to get an image on. But at a certain point, I decided to let the grid remain a visible part of the image. Initially, I would get rid of the grid so nobody knew that I used it. But at a certain point, I began to leave the incremental unit to show. And I found all kinds of ways, from using my own fingerprints to gluing on little wads of pulp paper to any one of a number of ways of working incrementally and letting the individual unit show. One of the things I like about working that way is that there's nothing about the building block which says anything about what's going to be made from it.
Exactly. Exactly.
There's no mark that equals hair. There's no mark that equals skin or anything else. It's a little bit like an architect choosing a brick. The brick doesn't determine anything about what kind of building will be built from it. You stack up the bricks one way and you make a gas station, or you stack up the bricks another way and you can build a cathedral. Both of them will be very different experiences, but it wasn't the brick that determined the nature of that experience.
So what suits your personality about working in these smaller units, one dot at a time or one grid at a time?
Well, you know, actually, um, I I'm a nervous wreck. I'm a slob. I have no patience, and I'm rather lazy. All of those things would seem to guarantee that I would not make work like I make. But I felt I didn't want to just go with my nature and say, well, that's why I am. I can only make big, sloppy, nervous, quick paintings. I thought to construct a situation in which I couldn't behave that way was also to address my nature. But I found that one of the nice things about working this way, working incrementally, is that I don't have to reinvent the wheel every single day. Today I did what I did yesterday, and tomorrow I'll do what I do today. You can pick it up and put it down. I don't have to wait for inspiration. There are no good days or bad days. And I'm every day essentially builds positively on what I did the day before. In some ways, I think it's rather like what used to be called women's work, that is quilting, crocheting, knitting, or whatever. And the advantage of that way of working was that women could knit for a while, put it down, go feed the baby, come back and pick it up and knit a little more, and then put it down and go out and weed the garden. And it allowed for a way to just keep working. If a belief in a process, for instance, how do you make a sweater? Oh my God, I wouldn't know how to make a sweater. But if you believe in the process and you knit one and you purl two long enough, eventually you get a sweater. And I think, given my nature, it was very good for me to have a way to work in which I was able to add to what I already had and slowly construct the final image out of these little building blocks.
I want to say something else and get you to say something else about the current style that you're painting in. Your current painting style now is this really interesting mix of abstraction and representational painting, because what you're doing now, as we talked about, your paintings are based on a series of grids, and each grid is like a little abstract painting. Each grid is some circles of color or squares of color or squiggles of color, and this little abstract grid, when taken in the context of all the other little abstract grids, forms a face. Mm-hmm. But the faces have become more abstract than they used to be. They're not so much about finding every follicle, every pore.
Well, it's probably lucky that as I age and all of my friends age, that I've adopted a kinder, gentler strategy to painting, because I was in my 20s when I started, and we weren't as wrinkled, and there wasn't as much surface incident in people's faces, and so right now, it's probably a good thing that a lot of that surface information isn't showing up. But one of the things I get to finish one of those little paintings, one of those little abstract paintings, all the time, several a day or a whole bunch of them in a day. So I get a little piece of pleasure over and over and over, and a little piece of completion mm-hmm. over and over. And that's one of the really wonderful things about the way I work. But, I didn't start making representational imagery because I was against abstraction. As a matter of fact, my favorite work was usually abstract, often very minimal, and often sculpture.
Don't you feel like you found a way to combine all of those instincts into one canvas?
That's one of the nice things about it. I was a big, big fan as a student of de Kooning, who I still consider the greatest American artist of the 20th century. And I loved him so much, and I was I painted way more than my share of de Kooning's. In fact, when I met de Kooning late in life, I said it's very nice. Late in his life, I said it's very nice to meet somebody who's painted more de Kooning's than I have. But one of the problems with being a good student, and I was a good student, was that I knew what art looked like, and I could demonstrate that I knew what it looked like. But it must look like someone else's art, or it wouldn't look like art. And I couldn't find a way to work out of de Kooning and out of my heroes without making weak impersonations of their work. And one of the wonderful things about having purged myself of all those, purged my work of all those influences and driving myself in my own into my own idiosyncratic corner where no one else's answers would fit the question that I was asking myself, was that ultimately over the years I found a way to get a lot of that de Kooning color and some of the marks and things that I love so much back into my work. But now I get to use de Kooning color and make a Chuck Close instead of using de Kooning color and making a de Kooning.
Chuck Close, a pleasure to talk with you. Thank you very much for talking
with us.
Thanks
very much.
Chuck Close, speaking with Terry Gross in 1998. A new book collecting his art is called Chuck Close Work. Tomorrow night, the American Ballet Theater premieres a dance portrait inspired by his paintings. I'm David Bianculli, and this is Fresh Air.
Support for NPR comes from the Credit Union National Association, representing America's not-for-profit, cooperatively owned credit unions. Learn more at go.coop. From Fox Searchlight Pictures, presenting Wes Anderson's The Darjeeling Limited, about three brothers, 11 suitcases, and a laminating machine, now in select theaters. And from Delacorte Press, publisher of Tales from the Teacher's Lounge, and a reverent view of what it really means to be a teacher today, by Robert Wilder. This is NPR, National Public Radio.
Coming up, a year in the life of a pop music hit factory. Ed Ward tells us about Motown Records in 1965. And we'll talk with actor Richard Gere. His latest film, Hoax, is now out on DVD. Also, film critic David Edelstein reviews Before the Devil Knows You're Dead. I want you. This is Fresh Air. I'm David Bianculli, sitting in for Terry Gross. In 1964, Motown, a black-owned record company in Detroit, achieved the nearly impossible goal of dominating the American pop and soul charts. Could they keep it up? In his ongoing review of Hippo Select's year-by-year complete Motown singles series, rock historian Ed Ward takes a look at 1965.
Motown didn't waste any time trying to hold on to its leadership in 1965. On January 14th, they released their next number one record. We'll be right back. It was a record that almost didn't happen. First, Junior Walker's drummer wasn't able to get the rhythm right, and Berry Gordy sent in Benny Benjamin, Motown's main drummer. Then the vocals didn't show up, and Gordy angrily ordered Junior to sing it himself or go home. It was so good that nobody made the connection with The Murder of Sam Cooke, which happened soon after it was recorded, nor that of Malcolm X, which happened while the tune was at the top of the charts. There was only one number one released in February, The Supremes' Stop in the Name of Love. But there were two top ten records, too. Martha and the Vandellas' Nowhere to Run, Marvin Gaye's I'll Be Doggone, and this one by a new signing which just missed the top ten.
What are you gonna do when I'm gone? Whose shoulder are you gonna cry on? What are you gonna do on the day when I turn my head and just walk away now?
Brenda Holloway is one of the many talents Motown never really had any idea what to do with. In this case, she's singing a Smokey Robinson song on a track he'd produced for Mary Wells, who'd left the label the previous year. But this was an example of how Motown was getting stronger, too. By joining proven songwriting and producing talents with artists, Motown was simply adopting the Detroit automobile industry's approach. Over here, we have the Supremes, working with Holland Dozier and Holland, a division of the company which also produces the Four Tops. And over here, we have the Smokey Robinson division, which makes not only its own product, but is having remarkable success with the Temptations and produces a few other artists.
If it's love that you're running from, there's no hiding.
But this also meant that the developing and second-tier artists weren't always paid enough attention. Some of the records that fell through the cracks were by established artists who hadn't hooked up with a star production team, like this summertime stomper by Martha and the Vandellas, which should have done a lot better than languishing in the lower 20s. Martha and the Vandellas had a past and would have a future at Motown, as would another semi-neglected group, the Marvelettes. Going through this series, I've been struck by another girl group almost no one has ever heard of, who made a number of great records for Motown over the years, the Velvettes.
As I sit here in my lonely
Motown's big success story in 1965 was, in retrospect, getting the Four Tops established. The group had a long history before Motown, singing supper clubs and other high-class establishments, and it took a delicate touch to turn them just funky enough for Motown's audience. This was the year they succeeded, hitting with Can't Help Myself, It's the Same Old Song, Something About You, and this from the beginning of the year.
When you feel that you can make it all.
1965 turned out to be a watershed year for pop music in general, and Motown would start 1966 having to adapt to some serious changes if they wanted to stay on top. Still, they'd shown that their first few gold singles were no fluke, and there'd be a lot more where they came from.
Ed Ward lives in Berlin. He reviewed Motown singles from 1965 from Hippo Select's Year by Year series. Coming up, actor Richard Gere. This is Fresh Air. When the Dalai Lama accepted the Congressional Gold Medal earlier this month, George Bush was there to salute him, the first U.S. president ever to appear in public with the exiled spiritual leader from Tibet. Our next guest, actor Richard Gere, was there too. The longtime Buddhist has been accompanying the Dalai Lama on his current travels. Of course, Gere still is making films, and his recent movie, The Hoax, is out now on DVD. It's the true story of writer Clifford Irving, who in 1971 perpetrated an elaborate scam by pretending to be the authorized biographer of the reclusive Howard Hughes. Irving generated faked interview transcripts that helped earn him a lucrative advance. The hoax adds to a resume that, for Gere, already includes such films as Looking for Mr. Goodbar, Days of Heaven, American Gigolo, An Officer and a Gentleman, Pretty Woman, Unfaithful, and Chicago. Terry spoke with Richard Gere earlier this year, and asked him about one of the most memorable scenes from one of his most popular films.
An Officer and a Gentleman, another movie that kind of struck some kind of chord, particularly because of that last scene where you walk into the place where Deborah Winger's working, and you literally like pick her up and sweep her off the feet, and everybody applauds, and it's like, how many times is that going to happen in real life?
I remember a story.
It struck this chord, yeah.
Well, there was this, Bernardo Bertolucci was a friend of mine then, and we were talking about doing another movie, and he said he'd seen Officer and Gentleman. He said, I like the movie very much, but the ending is very fascist. And I kind of let it go, and then he said something else like that. And I went, wait a minute, what do you mean, fascist? He said, well, you know, when the army comes in the factory and the workers applaud. So there was an element of that. I never thought it would work, and I cautioned the director. Said, "Let's we don't have much money. Let's cut this scene and shoot something else that we know is going to be in the movie." And he said, "I know it's probably not, but let's shoot it anyway." So we did it full out, and everyone, you know, filled it with the emotions that were required. And I still was kind of skeptical, although it was a gas shooting it. You know, it was kind of a rush. Shooting the scene, coming into this factory of women workers, and you know, I had that vanilla ice cream naval suit on, and picked her up like Sir Galahad, and I never thought it would work. And frankly, it wasn't working great until Taylor got the right music under it, and then he found the right rhythm, the perfect rhythm for that music. And it, even for me, it worked.
I want to ask you about American Gigolo, which was written and directed by Paul Schrader. And you play a very high-class escort in this, who's hired by mostly wealthy older women.
The word now is a sex worker.
Yes.
That's
thank you.
That's the international term.
Yes, and you're often hired by older women who are visiting and who either want a thrill or just want to be desired. Particularly desired by somebody who's really attractive.
Beyond that, even if you really look at the root of it, it's just treated well.
They
just want to be treated well. Someone to notice them.
Let me play a short scene. This is a scene from early on where you're in. It's like a restaurant or a hotel bar, and you're glancing at an older woman played by slightly older woman played by Lauren Hutton. You think she wants to hire you, and she's doesn't realize you're a pro, and she's flattered by your attention. So here's the scene from American Gigolo.
Why did you come on to me?
Like I said, I made a mistake.
I heard you speaking French. Often in these big hotels, you run into women from foreign countries who may need a translator or a guide.
And they hire you?
Yes.
How many languages do you speak?
Five or six.
Plus the international language.
That's right.
So that's Lauren Hutton and my guest Richard Gere in a scene from American Gigolo. Did you realize when you made this scene the ways in which it was going to resonate culturally? And I think one of the ways it resonated culturally was just in terms of, I think the most iconic scene in the movie is like when you're taking your clothes out of the closet and of the drawers and you're laying them out on the bed.
That was so far beyond me. First of all, I don't think I even owned a suit at that point. And this was all Paul Schrader.
Mm-hmm.
Paul had this thing about, I think he called it the new dandyism, and he was very prescient about this. It was Giorgio Armani, it was very stylized clothes, and this whole thing about shirts and picking out a tie that went with the shirt and the thing and all. I mean, this was a total construct. I didn't know anything about this, but I went with it, and I said, okay, let's give this a try.
It's funny that it didn't become famous as like a crime story. It became famous.
No, it's about style.
Yeah, you know, it's the movie exactly. It became famous for style. Yeah,
but that's what it was really.
Mm-hmm,
it
mm-hmm.
really was about two-dimensional realities, magazine realities.
Mm-hmm.
You know, and a kind of tendency, especially in the West, to see things in surfaces. But yeah, I mean, this was Paul's idea, which it was way ahead of its time of people being sucked into two-dimensional surface realities
mm-hmm.
with the body, with the clothes, with the hair, with the right sunglasses, with the walk, with the... It's all about presentation without substance. So you see this guy systematically being stripped of all style, all surface, and ends up in jail, leaning up against a glass window, where he touches the girl through the window. They put hands up against glass. It's someone who has to start from ground zero and actually build a human being now instead of a Cupid doll.
I'm so glad that you describe this as being a movie about people who are sucked up in two-dimensional realities, because that kind of answers the question that I was going to ask you. You know, most people know that you've been, practicing and studying Buddhism for many years. And, of course, you know, the kind of... you know, narcissism and materialistic culture that the character in American Gigolo represents is exactly what Buddhism is about not doing. It's about kind of transcending.
I'm thinking of a scene in the movie that actually is the opposite of that. And mm-hmm. you can't play these things and you can't be two-dimensional playing a two-dimensional person. You have to be three. You have to show the possibility of three plus dimensions
mm-hmm.
and that it's been squeezed into two in the story. But there's a scene in there, as I recall, where he's surfacing a woman, and I think her husband has paid me to do this, and he wants to watch. And she's very, she's nauseated by this. And if I'm remembering this scene, I just tell her it's all right. Just relax and forget about him. And I was just very nice with her, very gentle and in his way, sensitive with her. And within his own structure, he's a mensch. Now, in terms of the world and what's legal and what isn't, he's a bad guy. But within what he does, he is there to provide his service in a very real way and takes it very seriously. And those are real human moments in the movie.
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm, mm-hmm. Were you already interested in Buddhism then?
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I've been practicing since my early 20s.
You know, I know that you know the Dalai Lama, and he's pretty famous for different reasons, of course, but... you've had to learn how to deal with fame. I wonder if watching him and how he deals with his own kind of fame has been interesting and valuable for you.
It's had an enormous impact on me. I don't know any actor or artist or anyone else who, by inclination, wants the negative side of being famous, the lack of privacy, the sense of being in a fishbowl. Nobody wants that. And I see His Holiness go through that his whole life, since he was 2 years old and he was discovered. And the incredible patience and grace that he deals with that was enormously instructive to me.
I read that you were banned as an Academy Award presenter back in around 1993. While presenting an award, you used it as an opportunity to condemn the Chinese government for the occupation of Tibet.
It was slightly different than that.
Yeah, explain what happened, because I just read about it.
I wasn't condemning. I mean, I certainly told the truth, but my whole thing with the Chinese is that for them to do the right thing is good for them. For them to do the wrong thing is bad for them. Forgetting everyone else. If you have any concern for the Chinese, they're creating a horrendous future for themselves by being not compassionate and being bad in the present. So my approach with them is really just to encourage them to be the best government, the best people that they can be, and to treat everyone else like brothers and sisters.
But anyway, so you use the Academy Awards as an opportunity to say something
sure,
about
absolutely.
China. Were you warned beforehand not to do that, or did they explain why they banned you afterwards?
I don't know why. I mean, obviously I spoke, and the powers that be were not pleased, which was okay with me.
Was the orchestra trying to play you off as you spoke?
No, I don't think they were. I think I went into some slightly mad monologue about something similar to what I just said, and then I presented some award. I even forget what it is now, what it was. But it was, there are 6 million Tibetans inside of Tibet. There's about 150,000 Tibetans who've gotten out, and they need our help.
And just one more thing on this. Did you get a letter saying, "Dear Richard Gere, you'll never again present on this stage"? how did they let you know?
No, they told my agent. They said, "He will never, ever, ever be on this stage again." So.
Well, I want to thank you so much for talking with us.
Enjoyed it.
Richard Gere speaking to Terry Gross earlier this year. His film The Hoax, in which he stars as bogus biographer Clifford Irving, is now out on DVD.
Just a gigolo, every place I go, the people know the part I'm playing. Pay for every dance, selling each romance, every night some heart betraying. There will come a day, youth will pass away. What will they say about me? When the end comes, I know they'll say I'm just a gigolo, as life goes on without me.
That's guitarist and singer Marty Gross. Coming up, David Edelstein reviews Before the Devil Knows You're Dead. This is Fresh Air. We'll be right back. The title of veteran director Sidney Lumet's new movie comes from an old Irish toast. May you be in heaven half an hour before the devil knows you're dead. The movie Before the Devil Knows You're Dead revolves around a botched jewel heist and stars Philip Seymour Hoffman, Ethan Hawke, and Albert Finney. Film critic David Edelstein has a review.
Before the Devil Knows You're Dead is a robbery thriller in which events go from very bad to even worse to as grotesquely awful as you can possibly imagine. It's primal stuff, undiluted by redemption. It would be criminal to orient you too much. Kelly Masterson's script hopscotches around in time and fills in the characters as it goes along. It aims to keep you off balance. But it's fair to lay out the basics. The film centers on two brothers, Hank, played by Ethan Hawke, and Andy, played by Philip Seymour Hoffman, completely dissimilar and yet equally desperately in debt. It's Andy who approaches Hank with a scheme he's sure will get them both out of trouble.
You need money? So do I. Let's solve it.
What are you talking about?
There's a place we can knock off. You know, like the back of our hand. Easiest money we'll ever get.
What are you saying?
It's worth about 600 grand. And it's insured, so it's a victimless crime. I offer that in case your faggoty little conscience bothers you. I lay it off on 20 cents on the dollar. That's 60 grand each, give or take.
I can't believe this is you that's talking.
Believe it. So it's safe. Nobody gets hurt. Everybody wins. It's perfect.
We know from the start that the robbery is a dead, stupid idea. Before the Devil Knows You're Dead hinges on where that idea came from and why it can lead nowhere good. The director is the 83-year-old Sidney Lumet, whom critics have lately been hailing as the master of New York City filmmaking. The assessment is generous. For every great Lumet picture, like Serpico and Dog Day Afternoon, there are maybe four stinkers. I note ungenerously his checkered career to underscore his achievement here. His touch in Before the Devil Knows You're Dead is so sure, so spare, so perfectly weighted that it's hard to imagine him capable of making a bad movie. The opening is off-putting, to say the least. It's a fairly explicit sex scene between Marissa Tomei and Philip Seymour Hoffman, who does not, as he'd be the first to admit, have a body for soft core. But his naked passion shows us a side of the character we wouldn't otherwise see. Andy is an accounts manager at a realty company, but we don't know that yet, only that he'd like to flee his life. Nor do we know the identity of a masked thug who bursts into a suburban jewelry store owned by Nanette, played by Rosemary Harris, while Hawks Hank, in a ludicrous disguise, waits in a car with the motor running. Catastrophe follows, but before we go further, the film skips back 4 days, then forward, then a few days back, and just as we think enough of this pretzeled syntax, we're pulled into the story again. If Lumet is to be faulted, it's for allowing his actors to emote like crazy with the camera too close. Hawke would be even more compelling from a couple of feet back and with his twitches reduced by a third. The close-up is also no friend to Albert Finney as Nanette's husband Charles, a snorting bull best viewed from the other side of the fence. The exception to the too-close rule is Hoffman, who is huge but mesmerizing. At first, Andy is borderline monotonic and over-controlled, dangerously over-controlled, given what's festering beneath. In the face of disaster, he pulls even deeper into himself, but begins to reel like a man with an inner ear infection. By the time he acts out, he has no defenses left. He's stripped down to pure rage. It can be argued that the characters are peons. Neither Andy nor Hank has much stature, so their fates don't rise to the level of tragedy. But under Lumet's sympathetic gaze, their anguish gets into your bloodstream. Before the Devil Knows You're Dead transcends melodrama. It's a crime and punishment story that's finally about, to borrow the title of an earlier and very bad Lumet film, family business, primal injuries that lead inexorably to primal sins. It seems rooted in an ancient woe.
David Edelstein is film critic for New York Magazine. Fresh Air's executive producer is Danny Miller. Our engineer is Audrey Bentham. Dorothy Farabee is our administrative assistant. Sue Spolin directed the show. Our digital production project supervisor is Julian Hirschfeld. WHYY's executive producer of national radio programming is Elizabeth Perez-Luna. Our theme music was composed by Joel Forrester and performed by the Microscopic Septet. For Terry Gross, I'm David Bianculli.
Support for NPR comes from Barnes & Noble, publishers of their classics edition of The Essential Tales and Poems of Edgar Allan Poe, in stores and online at bn.com. From Carpenter Company, maker of bed pillows and other innovative products designed to help people sleep better. Z-score test and sleep tips available at carpenter.com. And from MGM, presenting Lars and the Real Girl, a heartfelt comedy starring Ryan Gosling, now playing in select cities, starts Friday everywhere. This is NPR, National Public Radio.
On the next Fresh Air, from checkmate to head of state, we talk with Garry Kasparov. He was the youngest ever world chess champion. He's now running for president of Russia against Vladimir Putin. Kasparov is part of an opposition coalition known as the Other Russia. Join us for the next Fresh Air.